1950, drawing upon Sino-Vietnamese models and experiences, Ho Chi Minh presided over the creation of the Lao and Khmer National Fronts, the Pathet Lao, Lao Nation, from the previous Lao Asara, the Free Lao Organization, and Khmer Asarak, Independent Khmer, out of the earlier Free Khmer Movement. Vietnamese communists then created two respective resistance governments, Chinh Phu Khang Chien, to stand next to the Democratic Republic of Vietnam. In order to attract popular support, the Vietnamese turned to disgruntled Laotian royalty in the person of Prince Sao Phanao Vong and to Cambodian Buddhism in the person of a Khmer Vietnamese monk named Son Ngoc Minh. Both were fluent in Vietnamese. They followed this up with instructions to cadres in western Indochina and among the Vietnamese diaspora in Thailand to create proto-communist parties for Laos and Cambodia, while Vietnamese officers led by Vo Nguyen Giap began building liberation armies. New possibilities and forms of collaboration emerged as Vietnamese communists initiated their own state-building projects. The son of a Vietnamese bureaucrat in Laos, Quezon Pham Vi Hain, joined Giap in creating the Pathet Lao Army. Thanks to the Vietnamese, he and Sao Phanao Vong would, one day, rule Laos. What explains Communist Vietnam's attraction for the rest of Indochina? On the one hand, it was a matter of national security. The communists needed allies in Laos and Cambodia to help them in the event the French turned their associated states on DRV Vietnam militarily, with American support. They also needed their own friendly states in Laos and Cambodia to prevent the West from attacking them diplomatically by accusing DRV troops or cadres in Laos and Cambodia of violating the territorial sovereignty of the states now led by Norodom Sihanouk and Sisavang Vong. The disappearance of French Indochina as a sovereign territorial bloc would now have real legal implications. By creating national borders between Vietnam on the one hand and Laos and Cambodia on the other. This is why the communists needed a policy of association of their own. Despite the fact that Ho Chi Minh's team had changed the party's name from that of the Indochinese Communist Party to the Vietnamese Workers' Party, Vietnamese communists still managed to lead revolutionary Indochina through their own, indirect, communist policy of association. On the other hand, Vietnamese communists believed in Indochina. They believed in the Comintern-approved model holding them to bring communist modernity, civilization, and socio-political revolution not just to Vietnam, but also to Laos and Cambodia. A devout internationalist, Ho himself had helped create communist parties for Malaya and Thailand 2 decades earlier, and may well have created the first communist cell in Laos in 1929. The only difference between the French colonialists and the Vietnamese Communist Internationalists in 1950 was that the latter actually created Lao and Cambodian states where none had existed before. The result was nonetheless the same. 2 sets of opposing associated states of Indochina, 6 in all, came into being during the First Indochina War, one under the French colonialists, the other under the Vietnamese communists ruling through a revolutionary protectorate. Ironically, as Ho Chi Minh and his entourage were hosting Sao Phanao Vong and Son Ngoc Minh in northern Vietnam to celebrate their revolutionary Indochinese ties in 1950, Albert Sorau explained to their opposites at the Conference of Pau in France why the Indochinese Federation had had to give way to the Associated States of Indochina within a French Union. Sorau described it as a continued creation. Ho would have agreed. And because men like Truong Chinh, Ho Chi Minh, Leon Pignon, and Jean Cousseau continued to cast their wars and state-making in these Indochinese ways, they guaranteed that war would come to Laos and Cambodia with all of its devastating consequences. Similar transnational state-making occurred inside DRV Vietnam itself. Mao Zedong and Joseph Stalin's decision to recognize Ho Chi Minh's Vietnam in January 1950 ended the Democratic Republic of Vietnam's international isolation and reincorporated the Vietnamese Communist Party into the internationalist fold it had first joined in the early 1930s. Like the French, Vietnamese communists welcomed the internationalization of the conflict. Not only did it provide them with military assistance, but it also provided them with direct access to international communist models for modernization and state building. While Pinh Nhung called on the West to stand united behind the French to keep Vietnam free from communism, Truong Chinh promised the communist bloc that it could count on the Vietnamese to lead the Indochinese Revolution and assume the Southeast Asian burden in the global battle against Western capitalism and imperialism. In exchange, he called upon Moscow, Beijing, and their allies to assist the Vietnamese. Positioned on the Asian front line of the Eurasian Communist Bloc, the Chinese took the lead. They were determined to ensure their new state's security and expand communism where they could. With Stalin's approval, Mao Zedong supported his longtime communist allies located on China's vulnerable flanks, Ho Chi Minh in Indochina and Kim Il-sung in Korea. A high-ranking Chinese communist emissary, Luo Quibo, traveled to the Democratic Republic of Vietnam in February 1950 to help them make a list of Vietnamese needs. Militarily, the Vietnamese requested modern arms, machine guns, artillery, ammunition, assistance in creating a professional army, and medicines. Politically, they wanted to help build a bona fide single-party communist state along the Maoist lines that had just led the Chinese Communist Party to victory. This included the introduction of Sino-Soviet mobilization techniques, land reform, and advice on and models for creating a communist-orientated security service, economy, education system, and culture. A remarkable transnational transformation of Vietnamese statecraft began in the DRV zones in Vietnam in 1950, and this in the middle of a full-blown colonial war, which was now turning into one of the hottest conflicts of the Cold War. Meanwhile, the Americans threw their weight behind the Associated States of Indochina, Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam. As Luo Quibo was visiting the Democratic Republic of Vietnam, the American State Department dispatched Robert Griffin to tour Indochina at the request of the French government. Accompanying his February visit was the first courtesy call of the 7th Fleet to Saigon, just as Pinh Nhung had requested a few weeks earlier, and which Mao now feared. Griffin met with the High Commissioner and the Military High Command, carefully listing the French economic and military needs for the Associated States of Indochina. On his return to Washington, Griffin urged his government to provide large-scale aid to Indochina in order to keep it and the rest of Southeast Asia from falling into communist hands. He also warned that if the United States did not aid the French, then they might well cut their losses and pull out of Indochina completely. Pinh Nhung had clearly gotten his message through and was drawing the Americans into protecting the Associated States of Indochina through the French. Growing anxieties over Korea reinforced the commitment of the main belligerents to support their allies. Within months, as they slid toward war in Korea, the Americans and the Chinese dispatched military advisor groups to Indochina. In September, American General Francis Brink presided over the creation of the Military Assistance Advisory Group, MAAG, in Saigon. Between September 1950 and May 1953, the Americans supplied 286,000 tons of material to French Union forces. In 1952, Washington had assumed around 40% of the military financial burden. By 1954, it reached almost 80%. It is not so much that the Americans were buying the war from the French. It was rather an indication of the fact that it was becoming their war too, and that they were fighting it indirectly through the French-run Associated States of Indochina, the French Expeditionary Corps, and the Indochinese armies the French now agreed to build for Laos, Cambodia, and most importantly, Vietnam itself. Although the Communist bloc could never match the quantity or the modernity of the American military aid to the French, the Chinese committed themselves to helping their allies in Vietnam in order to protect their southern flank, contain American expansionism in the Pacific, and keep a communist-run state alive, as they were doing in Korea. The Communist Chinese Advisory Group was created in 1950 and arrived in DRV Vietnam shortly after the Korean War began. Luo Guibo personally presided over two sub-delegations, the Military Advisory Group led by Generals Chen Jiang and Wei Guoqing, and the political one he personally directed. The military delegation channeled aid to the Vietnamese Army, trained troops and officers in northern DRV Vietnam and southern China, and helped devise battle plans. Between May 1950 and June 1954, the Chinese Communists provided 21,517 tons of assistance to the DRV Vietnamese. This included machine guns, rifles, ammunition, and artillery. The Chinese aim was not simply to build up the guerrilla war, but, as Mao Zedong had instructed his advisors, to organize a professional army. The Chinese did not create Ho's army, but they wanted to strengthen it in order to oppose the Franco-American threat on their southern flank indirectly. Meanwhile, the Chinese political delegation helped Vietnamese communists to create a veritable party state capable of running this new type of war. Chinese advisors introduced comprehensive rectification campaigns. This Maoist brainwashing specialty sought to train communist-minded cadres, a new class of civil servants, to run the party, the state, the army, and mass organizations. Reform and instruction started at the top of the party, thanks to courses organized by the Chinese delegation. Newly formed party schools then trained rectification specialists who fanned out across the country to inculcate party themes, instructions, and models for mid-level provincial officials and those further down the administrative chain. Together, these rectified and loyal bureaucrats and officers would form the backbone upon which a new party state would operate vertically, with the army and the security services receiving special attention. In 1952, based on Sino-Soviet communist techniques Luo Guibo's team introduced, Vietnamese communists formally launched the rectification campaigns. As the party began to consolidate its hold over the state, non-communist nationalists unwilling to undergo rectification were sidelined, persecuted, or defected. Ideological loyalty was essential to the functioning of this new single-party state born of war. To further increase party control and communize society, the Vietnamese accelerated Sino-Soviet-inspired new hero worship, patriotic emulation campaigns, and stepped up the cult of personality around Ho Chi Minh. New heroes, An Hung Moi, were exemplary men and women whom all Vietnamese were expected to venerate, not only for their patriotic and heroic deeds, but also for their revolutionary virtues and commitment to communism. Since 1948, the party had begun selecting socialist heroes from among the peasants, workers, and soldiers. Locally organized propaganda drives, schools, and the army encouraged all to emulate them. During the first half of the Indochina conflict, the Democratic Republic of Vietnam relied on patriotic emulation campaigns, Phong Trào Thi Đua Ái Quốc, as a way of mobilizing people to support the war against the French by providing labor, rice, and loyalty. Campaigns lasted from a few weeks to several months in length as cadres fanned out into the villages. Relying on local mass organizations, family ties, and propaganda, officials organized local fun and games, urging men and women in one village to try to outdo their counterparts in another for the good of the nation. In 1952, now engaged in set-piece battles, communists reorganized the emulation campaigns under strict party control, backed up by the army and police and advised by the Chinese, and focused them increasingly on class issues. From this point, patriotic landowners and bourgeois in the Democratic Republic of Vietnam zone, regardless of how much support they might have provided the cause over the years, became ideological impediments to the party's control over the state, territory, people, and its ability to transform them in communist ways. At the summit of the new hero worship and emulation campaigns was the party-sponsored worship of Ho Chi Minh, the perfect embodiment of communism and nationalism. New hero worship, emulation campaigns, and the cult of personality were all tools by which the party sought to increase its control and communize its civil servants and society. Again, this does not mean that all of Vietnam suddenly became or was destined to become communist, any more than one can speak of a timeless Confucian Vietnam covering all of the country down to ground level. However, like other centuries before them, Vietnamese communists now willingly looked to China for models to help them in building a new state, in centralizing party control right down to the grassroots, and in establishing ideological homogeneity. And like the Li dynasty's entry into the East Asian Confucian civilization in the 15th century, which had distinguished it from its Southeast Asian neighbors, something very similar happened in the mid-20th century, when Ho Chi Minh's party embraced Maoism and the internationalist communist movement from which it flowed in order to build a new state and army. This also means that the Chinese, as well as the Americans, were deeply involved in nation-building in Vietnam. Chinese advisors certainly introduced the Sino-Soviet model for communist land reform. It was another instrument by which the party could destroy feudal and other social structures in the countryside in order to replace them with the new ones. Maoist land reform further reinforced the party's vertical control over the state and, theoretically, its ability to mobilize peasants. Not only did the party accord the peasants a plot of land in order to generate their support, but it also began recruiting them into the bureaucracy, the army, and the security services. This social revolution in the countryside began in late 1953 as the war against the French reached its denouement and continued until 1956. We will return to this question later. The Vietnamese used all of these Sino-Soviet techniques to make the transition to modern conventional war as well. A year before the Chinese advisors arrived in 1950, Vietnamese communists had already begun shifting the third phase of Maoist military strategy, the general counteroffensive. Although the Democratic Republic of Vietnam never abandoned guerrilla operations, these were no longer sufficient. The only way to drive the French out of Indochina and create the conditions for remaking Vietnam was through decisive military force. This meant that the DRV had to field a professional army capable of winning military victory on the battlefield. Thanks to Chinese assistance and instruction, including the outfitting and training of tens of thousands of troops in the safety of Chinese territory, the Democratic Republic of Vietnam was now in a position to push its military revolution forward by building main force regiments and divisions, a much better trained officer corps, general staff, and by deploying thousands of party-trained political cadres in its ranks. By 1952, Chinese training and military aid had helped the Vietnamese to assemble a regular army consisting of six armed divisions. It operated via expanding and increasingly professionalized intelligence, logistics, supply, and medical services. In mid-1950, and not before, the People's Army of Vietnam, Quân Đội Nhân Dân Việt Nam, otherwise known as PAVN, was born. Its birth paralleled the emergence of the American-backed one for the Associated State of Vietnam. Both armies now operated on international models, coming from opposite sides in the Cold War. Ho Chi Minh thus presided over a political and a military revolution in a time of war. Between 1950 and 1954, these divisions and the party state emerging to run them allowed the Democratic Republic of Vietnam to take the fighting to the French across Upper Vietnam and into Western Indochina during eight set-piece battles. In 1950, Von Nguyen Giap and his Chinese advisors focused on opening a direct supply route in the border province of Kaobang in order to create a safe passage to China. Giap threw his best troops against retreating French Union troops, scoring a spectacular victory that cost Léon Pignon his job and made thousands of French Union troops DRV prisoners of war. Emboldened, General Giap turned his attention to the Red River Delta and set his sights on Hanoi. The new French High Commissioner and Commander-in-Chief, General Jean de Lattre de Tassigny, welcomed his opponent's willingness to engage in set-piece battle, convinced that superior French air and firepower, now backed up by the Americans, would ensure victory. Giap overreached and paid for it dearly in a bloody defeat during the Battle of Vinh Yenh in January 1951 and a second one a few months later at Dong Tru. As the French had themselves learned during the First World War, fervor and attacks made in waves did not guarantee victory in modern war. Wave attacks on the Red River Delta in 1950-51 left tens of thousands of PAVN soldiers maimed and killed, destroyed by the very things the guerrilla army had always avoided: artillery, machine guns, and bombers. Thanks to the Americans, the French also dropped napalm for the first time. A People's Army of Vietnam veteran of Vinh Yenh later recalled the experience. "Be on the watch for planes. They will drop bombs and machine gun you. Cover yourselves, hide yourselves under bamboo." The planes dived. Then hell opened up before my eyes. It was hell in the form of a big, clumsy egg falling from the first plane. An immense ball of fire spreading over hundreds of meters, it seemed to me, sowing terror in the ranks of the soldiers. Napalm. Fire that falls from the sky. My men ran for cover, and I could not stop them. There is no way you can stay put under this rain of fire that spreads out and burns everything in its path. From everywhere the flames leap up. Joining them was the burst of French machine gun fire, mortars, and artillery, transforming into a burning tomb that was only 10 minutes earlier a small forest. The phosphorus gel also fell on innocent civilians, including children. As a 12-year-old, Nguyen Cong Hoan recalled how his best childhood friend, Hu, was lying on the ground, burned by napalm. "She wasn't dead, but she was dying. We sat around her at night watching her. Her body glowed with phosphorus." The Vietnamese and their Chinese advisors abandoned any hope of taking the Delta quickly. From late 1951 onward, they shifted their attention to the highlands, where the jungle canopy and long distances would prevent the French from concentrating their firepower on attacking PAVN forces. It was in this context that Giap and his advisors focused on controlling Hoa Binh, a strategic interchange located between the highlands and the plains and between northern and central Vietnam. In November 1951, De Lattre de Tassigny recovered Hoa Binh in order to thwart his enemy's attempts to push through a supply route towards central and southern Vietnam, to infiltrate troops into the Delta, and to reassure Highland minority groups of French resolve. Giap was determined to take Hoa Binh for all these same reasons, and saw an advantage in attacking the French there, given the craggy, mountainous terrain. Attacking at night, hoping to avoid the full brunt of French air power, in December 1951, Giap threw thousands of men against the French Union forces in a bid to encircle, overwhelm, and destroy the camp. Fighting was intense, with French artillery inflicting heavy losses on the Democratic Republic of Vietnam's troops again. On the 22nd and 23rd of February, as the Vietnamese massed for a final knockout punch, the French withdrew their troops. It was a victory, but an incomplete one for Giap. The DRV wanted a decisive win, and so did the French, criticized by their American counterparts for failing to take the battle to the enemy. In late 1952, in a bid to block the Democratic Republic of Vietnam from taking control of northwestern Vietnam and eastern Laos, De Lattre de Tassigny transformed Na San, a small upland village located along the Lao border, into a major entrenched position, which bulldozers cleared of trees while soldiers and thousands of civilian workers marched in to dig trenches, install heavy artillery, and helped to build an airbase to supply the camp from afar. Some 20,000 men turned it into a fabulous war industry for the time. General Giap was confident that he could win, but he miscalculated at Na San. On the 30th of November, the People's Army of Vietnam commander sent waves of his troops against the camp, but was shocked by the ferocity of the French response. Enemy artillery and airstrikes decimated his young PAVN soldiers. No sooner had the battle started than Giap had to call it off. The Vietnamese lacked the artillery needed to knock out such a fortified position, nor did they have the logistical capacity to transport large quantities of food, arms, and equipment to the front line to sustain such an assault. Giap also realized that his inability to destroy the airstrip meant that the French could continue to supply it. Instead of taking Na San, the Vietnamese ended up going around it. The Vietnamese learned three things from this defeat, however: the need for better logistics, heavy artillery, and the ability to sever the enemy's air supply. Giap would not forget this, as his party began preparations to win at Dien Bien Phu. Total war in the Global South? In order to make the transition to modern war and transform the state and society in communist ways, the DRV had to mobilize on an unprecedented social scale and in record time. To do so, the government incorporated mandatory military service in late 1949, declared a state of general mobilization in early 1950, and initiated full-scale land reform to induce its majority peasant population to defeat the French and the feudal landowning class at the same time. As Truong Chinh spelled it out, those who have riches must contribute money. Those who have their manpower must contribute their strength. Those with talents must donate them. This is the time that requires us to apply correctly the method of total people's resistance, total resistance, Tuan Dien. No one, the Secretary General declared, can roam the shores of the resistance war. In addition, in order to ensure that weapons, ammunition, medicines, and especially food actually reached soldiers on the battlefields, the DRV needed a logistical system. The problem was that the People's Army of Vietnam lacked mechanized transport, no trucks, no planes, no ships. To take the battle to the French, the Democratic Republic of Vietnam thus had to rely disproportionately on human and animal force, drafting hundreds of thousands of civilians as porters, requisitioning tens of thousands of bicycles, rafts, horses, and oxen, all the while pushing peasants to produce more rice to feed the growing army and phalanx of civilian transporters. As a result, the party's decision to fight a modern war and to create a large standing army, but to do so via massive mobilization of people like their Chinese counterparts, made this conflict an ever more totalizing one in terms of its social reach. The already blurred line between civilians and combatants broke down massively in northern and central Vietnam when the Vietnamese engaged in 8 set piece battles between 1950 and 1954, which relied almost entirely on human and animal transport. Not only did the Vietnamese communists maintain the guerrilla war, as the Algerian and the Indonesian Republic's fighters did, but they also doubled it up with a conventional war which carried within it a full-blown social and military revolution. Starting in early 1950, with military draft and full mobilization laws on the books, the party dispersed its cadres across Democratic Republic of Vietnam territories, backed by the police and the army, to work with district and village authorities to recruit, organize, and mobilize civilian manpower for the war effort. these cadres relied on local mass organizations, kinship ties, personal relations, peasant, youth, and women's associations, as well as force to recruit and requisition labor. Those who balked faced legal prosecution and incarceration. Emulation, rectification, and the New Heroes campaigns exhorted local populations to support the army, the state, and the war cause by providing labor. For those who joined the civilian logistical apparatus, efforts were made to take care of their families, replace their labor in the fields, and guarantee financial support to the family in the event of the injury or death of those drafted. Before being mobilized, these civilian laborers received an official military status, that of fighter laborer, Qian Si Dang Kong. These porters received crash courses in patriotism and socialism. Then, off they marched under the guidance of the party cadres. The number of civilians the DRV mobilized into its logistical service is mind-boggling. During the first major battle of the Indochina War, which ended in the French retreat from Cao Bang in late 1950, the DRV mobilized 121,700 civilians. In his bid to take the Red River Delta from the French at Vinh Yen in early 1951, Vo Nguyen Giap relied on 300,000 porters. The numbers peaked during the Battle of Hoa Binh in late 1951 and early 1952, when there were 333,200 fighter laborers. The burden of this social mobilization occurred in villages running from northwestern Vietnam to areas in the central part of the country. With the shift from the Delta to the highlands in late 1951, the Democratic Republic of Vietnam expanded its territorial control over upland rural areas in the northwest, in the highlands in central Vietnam, and into eastern Laos and Cambodia. Mobilization not only brought war to civilians in these ethnically non-Viet territories, but in so doing, it simultaneously introduced the party state as the People's Army of Vietnam increased its territorial control. In 1954, 200,000 porters followed the PAVN as it engaged French Union and Associated State of Vietnam forces violently in the Central Highlands. In all, between 1950 and 1954, the DRV mobilized 1,741,381 people as civilian porters, almost all of them peasants. The PAVN's manpower needs led cadres to recruit more and more women into its logistical ranks. They were made to push rice-laden bikes across rugged territory, carry heavy packs over hundreds of kilometers, and to help rebuild bombed-out roads and bridges. It was grueling work, sometimes lasting several months, 6 months for the Battle of Dien Bien Phu. And of the 122,000 civilians mobilized for the Battle of Cao Bang in late 1950, the majority were women. This high level of female participation apparently remained the case for the following battles. If true, this would mean that the total number of women civilians involved in military logistics would equal at least half of the total number of all those mobilized, 1.7 million. Therefore, about 850,000 women out of the total Democratic Republic of Vietnam-controlled population of 10 million. While DRV women did not hold combat positions like their Soviet counterparts did during the Second World War, the former often found themselves involved in military operations. Thao Thi Vinh, a female porter who was about 25 in 1954, recalled her experience during the Battle of Dien Bien Phu as follows. "I worked as a porter behind the front lines. I only came to the front lines one time. On the way there, we carried ammunition, and on the way back, the injured. We had to climb up the slopes of the mountains or passes. Falls were commonplace. To carry a crate of ammunition, it took two volunteers. On the way back, these two could take care of one wounded person. Every 2 or 3 kilometers, we stopped and asked the injured person if he wanted to drink or piss. When he wanted water, we had to bring it to his lips. Many soldiers suffered. They moaned out of pain. We didn't know how to take care of them. All we could do was encourage them. Sometimes they did not survive their wounds and died en route. At night we marched, and during the day we rested. We were careful when we carried the wounded. When we carried supplies and ammunition, we would sometimes sleep while walking, we were so tired. From 1950 onward, the French, too, mobilized the Vietnamese population in unprecedented numbers. Upon his arrival in Indochina, General De Lattre de Tassigny pushed Bao Dai to institute the draft in mid-1951 and modernize the Associated State of Vietnam's army with American assistance. Thanks to the obligatory military service, the ASV Army numbered 167,000 troops by 1954. To this, one must add the 200,000-strong Expeditionary Corps, bringing total French Union forces facing the People's Army of Vietnam in 1954 to 350,000 soldiers. In other words, there were three conventional armies now in play, one French, two Vietnamese. All of them were increasingly well-armed and competing intensely for Vietnamese recruits and laborers. In all, almost 500,000 regular troops were in uniform. The two Vietnams each also counted around 300,000 rural militiamen and women in their territories. DRV militia forces protected their villages from French attacks, but didn't engage with the French army directly. From 1950, Franco-Vietnamese forces also recruited Vietnamese labor on a large scale. These civilian porters, called supplétifs, auxiliaries, accompanied troops into battle zones, often moving with their whole families. In 1954, they numbered in all around 100,000 individuals. As the intensity and cost of the war increased from 1950 onward, the French found themselves looking for other sources of labor, and this led them to begin using prisoners of war, prisonniers internés militaires, to help them in their fight in what might well have been a violation of the Geneva Convention. While there is no study of this question, the total number of prisoners of war probably numbered in all, between 1950 and 1954, 100,000 men and apparently women too. Like the DRV's logistical fighters, they helped the French repair roads, bridges, and transport supplies and equipment across the rugged terrain, which trucks and planes could only access with great difficulty. They also ended up in the line of fire. Ending the war? Dien Bien Phu, forcing decolonization in a set-piece battle. The Battle of Dien Bien Phu was one of the most important battles of the 20th century. Between November 1953 and May 1954, the DRV organized and then engaged the Western colonizer in a violent set-piece battle and won. One cannot understand the full significance of this epic clash without situating it in its Franco-Vietnamese, international, and military dimensions. On the French side, Prime Minister René Meyer was a vigorous believer in strengthening France's role in Europe and the Atlantic community. That the Americans were pushing to rearm West Germany in order to better contain the Soviet Union only reinforced the priority of Europe over Asia in French strategic thinking. Financially, France could not afford to continue an ever more costly conventional war in Indochina and still contribute to European defense. So, having invested massively in continuing their Asian empire, the French were now finding themselves in a war against the Democratic Republic of Vietnam, backed by the Chinese and the Soviets, when their real priority lay in defense of their homeland, half a world away. An honorable end, une sortie honorable, to the conflict had to be found. In May 1953, René Meyer named General Henri Navarre as commander-in-chief of the armed forces in Indochina. The French government instructed Navarre to create the necessary military conditions on the battlefield so that diplomats could reach a favorable solution at the negotiating table thereafter. Navarre came up with a two-pronged plan. During 1953-4, the Army would avoid large-scale battles with the enemy in order to rebuild French Union forces, and then, in 1954-5, deliver a decisive military blow to Giap's army in order to force the adversary to the negotiating table on terms favorable to the French. Second, upon his arrival in Vietnam, Navarre focused his attention less on the Northern Delta than on areas in central Vietnam controlled by the DRV. One of Navarre's main operations, Operation Atlante, was designed to retake southern central Vietnam from the Democratic Republic of Vietnam and place it under the ASV sovereign control before opening negotiations. At the outset, Navarre had no intention of fighting a major battle in the valley of Dien Bien Phu. Nor did his adversary, Vo Nguyen Giap. Like the French, the DRV leadership made decisions in 1953 that would affect the direction of the road leading to Dien Bien Phu and the negotiating table in Geneva. In the usual military conundrum, the pause the French gave themselves to rebuild and retain their forces allowed their opponents to do just the same. In January 1953, the party accelerated preparations to implement land reform and mobilized the logistics needed to win a major battle. Giap's high command decided that not only did the army have to bring in its own artillery and anti-air defense forces to take out an entrenched enemy position in any future battle, but it also had to devise a strategy to disperse the Expeditionary Corps' troops across Indochina so that they would not be able to concentrate forces in the event that the French would try to repeat the strategy they used in the Battle of Na San. Throughout 1953, the DRV reorganized its main artillery regiment, created a new one, and constituted its first anti-air battalion. Most importantly, the Vietnamese and Chinese agreed that the Democratic Republic of Vietnam needed to score a major battle victory in light of the international détente which the death of Joseph Stalin and the armistice in Korea had opened up by mid-1953. All of this was underway on the Vietnamese side when the French adopted the Navarre Plan in July 1953. By mid-September 1953, the DRV's intelligence services had acquired a good understanding of the basic elements of the Navarre Plan. This allowed the Vietnamese Politburo, its supreme policy-making body, to better devise its own strategy. Because Navarre was massing his forces to occupy and hold the Tonkin Lowlands, the Politburo decided, "We will force him to disperse his forces out to other sectors so that we can annihilate them." Rather than trying to attack the Delta, where the French could easily concentrate their artillery and air power with devastating effect, the Politburo decided to disperse the French toward northwestern Vietnam and upper Laos, then toward central and southern Laos, and even as far as northeast Cambodia. In mid-November 1953, the Vietnamese Politburo approved its winter-spring plan along these lines. Thinking that his opponents were bent on taking Laos, Navarre decided to commit troops to Dien Bien Phu on the main route to Laos to stop them from moving westward. But Laos was never the DRV's goal. Diversion was, and it worked. On the 20th of November, the French began by parachuting 6 battalions into Dien Bien Phu. Surprised, Giap immediately put 2 questions to his intelligence people. Is the enemy going to withdraw? And how are they deployed? Navarre's decision to send French Union troops towards southern central Vietnam in Operation Atlante, Laos, and northwestern Vietnam, and then to take a simultaneous stand at Dien Bien Phu, unexpectedly presented the Vietnamese High Command and Politburo with exactly the type of battle that they wanted to fight. Drawing upon the Na San battle experience, General Henri Navarre ordered the creation of an even bigger and more solidly entrenched camp in the valley of Dien Bien Phu. An airstrip would serve as the vital lifeline to supply some 15,000 French Union troops. Many high-ranking French and American military officials and politicians agreed that the camp could hold and break the back of the enemy's main forces, Cassis-du-Viet. or break the Vietnamese, was the expression. French artillery, air power, and resistance positions, each of which was given a feminine name from A to H, Beatrice, for example, would mow down the attacking enemy soldiers, destroy Giap's corps divisions, and thus hand the Vietnamese an even worse defeat than the one they had suffered at Na San. The French stationed 12 battle-hardened battalions to defend the valley in all. Morale ran high. Many were actually worried that the Vietnamese would not attack, mirroring, paradoxically, Von Nguyen Giap's fear that the French would pull out before he could, casse du Francais, break the French. The answer came on the 3rd of December, when Democratic Republic of Vietnam military intelligence informed Giap that Navarre had committed his side to battle. With the international context firmly in mind, the Vietnamese Politburo issued orders instructing the army to surround the camp and wipe it out entirely, all the while continuing the other campaigns designed to disperse the French forces as far across Indochina as possible. Massive mobilization began as hundreds of thousands of peasants started to transport rice, weapons, and artillery to the hills surrounding the camp. Chinese-supplied Soviet trucks hauled in weapons and rice from the Chinese border. The People's Army of Vietnam finally had mechanized logistics, but 250,000 civilian porters still had to carry supplies to the battlefield. The policy of land reform referred to earlier officially began in earnest in December 1953 in areas in Upper Central and Northern Vietnam, whose laborers supplied Dien Bien Phu. Meanwhile, on the 17th of December 1953, the Politburo approved a resolution about their policy of fighting and negotiation. This effectively meant that losing this battle was not an option. Victory had to be achieved at 100% before negotiations to end the war could begin, Ho told Giap. This need for certainty was why the DRV cancelled its initial attack against Dien Bien Phu, which had been planned for the 25th of January, 1954. However, even though Navarre realized in early January that the Vietnamese were successfully bringing artillery into Dien Bien Phu, he refused to cancel Operation Atlante. Moreover, rather than concentrating all his forces there, on the 29th of January, Navarre launched Operation Atlante against the Democratic Republic of Vietnam in central Vietnam, while Giap concentrated his best divisions on wiping out Dien Bien Phu. At the head of the elite 308th Division was General Vuong Thoa Vu, the man who had commanded the Battle of Hanoi. Hubris certainly explains part of the French miscalculation, but preparations, operations, and morale were so advanced by mid-January that it was too late for Navarre to pull out by air or via Laos without repeating the Cao Bang debacle and handing the adversary a de facto victory at a key point in international negotiations. The Berlin Conference, the 25th of January to the 18th of February, 1954, had brought together the USA, UK, France, and the USSR to discuss, among other things, the need to settle the two hot wars in Asia, those in Korea and Indochina. On the 13th of March, the Vietnamese finally let loose their artillery with deadly accuracy. They quickly knocked out a number of unprotected French artillery guns and destroyed the airstrip which severed the camp's lifeline to the outside within days. They also launched their first massive and costly attack on the same day as troops moved under heavy French artillery and machine gun fire to submerge the advance posts of Beatrice and Gabriel. However, in response, the French Union forces dug in, quite literally. Indeed, the battle for Dien Bien Phu strangely resembled the trench warfare of the First World War. Some spoke of Verdun. This is hardly surprising, since each side possessed artillery, which forced men to go underground to hide when they weren't ordered to go over the top and attack. What differentiated the Democratic Republic of Vietnam's use of trenches in 1954 from those at Verdun in 1916 was that the Vietnamese ones were mobile, expanding slowly to surround the enemy camp instead of forming a straight, static line. But like the trench warfare of the First World War, young Vietnamese boys ordered to attack suffered terrible casualties when they ran into intense machine gun and artillery fire, as did French Union forces counterattacking. For both sides, torrential rains quickly filled the trenches with mud, water, blood, and disease, as soldiers often had to make their way around rotting corpses. Although American pilots flew supply missions over Dien Bien Phu, Washington refused to try to save the camp by launching what would have been their own first direct military engagement, Operation Vulture, a major bombing campaign. The White House approved of indirect intervention in the form of advisors, military assistance, intelligence, and covert Central Intelligence Agency, CIA, operations, but not of putting official American troops on the ground or in the air. The French Union soldiers were on their own as the DRV's army launched two more wave attacks, extending their trenches meter by meter, hill by hill, slowly strangling the enemy until they reached the camp on the valley floor of Dien Bien Phu, and it finally fell on the 7th of May, 1954, at 1700 hours. That same day, negotiations formally began in Geneva to find a political solution to end the war. Over the next year, negotiations secured the release of tens of thousands of prisoners of war. The French returned 65,000 men and women prisoners to the Vietnamese in late 1954, but internal reports conceded that 9,000 had died in captivity or had been executed. For the 9,000 dead, only 2,080 graves could be identified. The Democratic Republic of Vietnam returned around 20,000 POWs taken between 1945 and 1954, but as many as 20,000 had disappeared in captivity, reported as absentees, missing, or unreturned. Thousands died as the DRV marched them for hundreds of kilometers from Cao Bang in 1950 and Dien Bien Phu in 1954 to insalubrious and often disease-ridden prisoner-of-war camps with little medical care. Families on both sides pleaded with their governments to find these POWs or their bodies. Geneva, 1954. A failed peace. While the Americans resisted, fearful that the communists would win by diplomacy what they could not achieve on the battlefield, the rest of the international community, including the British, were looking to cool down the two hot wars in the international system in Korea and Indochina. The death of Stalin in March 1953 and the end of the shooting in Korea a few months later opened the way for a thaw in what had until now been very bitter East-West relations. The new leadership emerging in Moscow wanted to reduce tensions in both Europe and Asia in order to focus on internal economic matters. Détente would facilitate this process. Their Chinese allies shared this view. The Korean and Indochinese wars had proved a heavy drain on the new Chinese state, as had radical social change and land reform. Zhou Enlai, now the seasoned foreign minister of Communist China, announced that a solution to the Indochina conflict could be found based upon the recent Korean model. Vietnamese communists duly noted Beijing's position, agreeing that the time was right to give peace a chance, all the while strengthening their position on the battlefield. On the 26th of November, 1953, in an interview with the Swedish paper Expressen, The Express, Ho Chi Minh had indicated his side's willingness to open negotiations to reach an eventual negotiated settlement to the war. The party's official line was now one of simultaneous fighting and negotiating. A month after Ho's interview, Truong Chinh issued a special clarification to cadres across the country explaining that the party's desire to open negotiations with the French was not a ploy. The time had come to negotiate as part of the Sino-Soviet shift toward international détente, Hoa Hong Kwok Te. The Soviets took the lead first. On the 28th of September 1953, Moscow had sent a note to France, Great Britain, and the United States, which proposed to hold an international conference in Geneva to ease international tensions. In Europe, this included the crucial question of Germany. In Asia, the conference would have to discuss the two major wars dividing the two blocs, those in Korea and Indochina. This conference, the Soviets argued, had to include the People's Republic of China, given that it was involved in both Asian wars, directly against the Americans in Korea and indirectly via Beijing's support of the Democratic Republic of Vietnam. On the 8th of October, Zhou Enlai expressed his support of the Soviet proposal. Easing tensions over Germany was first on the list of topics when French, British, Soviet, and American foreign ministers convened in Berlin in early 1954. When the Soviet Union failed to get Communist China recognized as one of the official powers at the upcoming conference in Geneva, the Americans agreed that the four main powers could invite delegations of their choice, which allowed the Soviets to invite the Chinese to take part in their first major international conference. The Soviets and British were co-presidents of the Geneva Conference. Besides the four powers plus China, the conference also included the main Indochinese parties concerned, the Associated States of Vietnam, Laos and Cambodia, and the Democratic Republic of Vietnam. Pham Van Dong led the DRV's delegation to Geneva. His government failed in its attempts to get its Associated States in Laos and Cambodia, the Pathet Lao and the Khmer Issarak, accepted officially at the negotiating table. The Sino-American split cast a long shadow over the Geneva Conference, the 26th of April to the 21st of July, 1954, from beginning to end. Zhou Enlai wanted an end to the First Indochina War, but also to find a solution which would keep the United States from replacing the French on China's southern flank. He had already begun developing a policy of peaceful coexistence toward non-communist countries in Asia in order to neutralize this part of the world against American attempts to bring those states into a collective security alliance to contain and, perhaps, even roll back communist China. On the American side, Washington threw its weight behind Chiang Kai-shek's Republic of China, now based on the island of Taiwan after its defeat by the Chinese communists, and signed a security treaty with him in 1954. But despite his strong opposition to dealing with the Chinese communists, the Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, went along with the French desire to try to negotiate an end to the war. Most importantly, the American Secretary of State did not want to endanger French ratification of the European defense community by opposing them at the Geneva Conference. On the 8th of May 1954, the day after Dien Bien Phu fell, the conference took up the question of Indochina. The French and the Democratic Republic of Vietnam adopted hard-line opening positions. The Vietnamese, having timed their military actions perfectly, felt that their historic victory on the battlefield permitted such confidence. The French government, led by the popular Republican movement's always hawkish Georges Bidault, made it clear that the French might have lost a battle, but not necessarily the whole war. Moreover, going into the Geneva Conference, Bidault was deeply involved in holding the French Union together, as Moroccans, Tunisians, and Algerians pressed for independence like the Vietnamese. Committed to the Atlantic Alliance, Bidault always connected Indochina to European questions and threatened to rally the more hardline American position, if need be, to get his way. With a green light from the Soviets to take the lead on solving this prickly